The next case on our calendar is 07-1199, 1372, and 1373. Ms. Broward.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and other justices. My name is Julia Brohard. I represent one of the appellants in this case, China Shipping. Mr. Thomas Wright represents the other appellant in this case, Container Port, and we will be splitting our time and reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves three issues, or actually two issues and a certified question that all fit together. The first issue involves proper service on a John Doe defendant. The second issue involves, if you have a John Doe defendant, how and under what circumstances might the savings statute apply to that case. The certified question comes into play because the decision of the lower court of appeals conflicts with the decisions of three other district courts on the savings statute issue. To begin with the John Doe question, this court held in the case of Amerine versus Houghton in 1989 that the civil rules regarding service on a John Doe defendant must be strictly complied with in order for that case to be timely under Rule 15C. So this court looked at Rule 15D, which gives several criteria for when you have to properly name and serve a John Doe defendant. The court then said you also have to look at 15C, which relates back, allows the amendment to add the John Doe defendant's real name to relate back to the date the complaint was filed, and also at 3A, which gives you 1 year from the date of the original complaint within which to file to properly serve the John Doe defendant. This court, applying that ruling, said that service by certified mail in that case was not proper because 15D calls for personal service. In the case at hand, there was only certified mail service, there was no personal service, and yet the court below said that certified mail service was adequate without ever discussing why it should not follow the Amerine case. Moreover, the court below said that as to my client, China Shipping, it was all right to serve China Shipping more than 1 year after the original complaint was filed. The court relied on this court's case of Goolsbee, which was decided in 1991. In Goolsbee, the plaintiff had filed his complaint long before the statute of limitations expired. When he finally attempted to serve the complaint more than 1 year later, but still before the statute expired, the court determined that he could have dismissed and refiled his complaint on the date he sought service and still be timely. So they were going to treat that request for service as effectively any dismissal and refiling, and they were going to permit it. Then in the 11th District, in the case of Fedoroff, took Goolsbee one step further, and they said, okay, if you're going to look at Goolsbee that you take an action before the original statute of limitations expires and say that it's okay, then in Fedoroff, they amended their complaint and requested service still before the statute of limitations expired, and so they said that was all right. In this case, however, neither Goolsbee nor Fedoroff apply because plaintiff here amended his complaint more than 1 year after the statute of limitations expired. In fact, it was almost more than 11 months after the statute expired. Plaintiff could not have dismissed his complaint on the day he filed his amended complaint and refiled. So Goolsbee does not apply. There was no effective dismissal and refiling, and plaintiff failed to serve China Shipping within 1 year as required by Civil Rule 3A. So the dismissal granted by the trial court was proper and should have been upheld by the appellate court. Now, this argument moves right into the savings statute argument. The court below said that, applying Goolsbee, it effectively, the amendment was a dismissal and then a refiling, so that the refiling came under the savings statute, and that therefore the plaintiff had a whole additional year from the date of the amendment within which to serve the defendants. But again, that doesn't work because Goolsbee doesn't apply, and so there was no effective dismissal and refiling so that the savings statute would even come into effect. There was only one suit. It was the suit that was filed in May of 2004, and the 1 year to serve expired on the anniversary date in May of 2005. There was no savings statute that even came into play. Even if the court says, okay, the amendment did effectively act as a dismissal and refiling, when you look at the application of the savings statute, clearly they didn't commence the suit. So you look to say, okay, did they attempt to commence the suit? We would suggest they did not. The initial suit, if you're going to say there's two lawsuits, the initial suit, they did nothing to commence that lawsuit. They filed it. There is no case holding that simply filing the complaint without more constitutes a commencement of the suit. The action that they took to request certified service occurred with the amended complaint. That's not what you look at for a savings statute. You look to see, did they attempt to commence properly the first complaint? Even if you get past all of that, then you come to the question, well, okay, the savings statute applies. Does the action of the attempt to commence, did they do enough to attempt to commence? We suggest they did not, because they still did not comply with what the John Doe requirements are. And the three cases that are in conflict with the court below all said that you need to look at the statute, the savings statute, and the civil rules all together. You can't take one without the other. And in the case of a John Doe defendant, we will say that to attempt to commence, you have to do it in accordance with the requirements of serving a John Doe defendant, which requires personal service, among other things. And if you didn't at least attempt to personally serve, then you did not properly attempt to commence your first case, and the savings statute does not save the lawsuit. I will let my
counsel, would you be able to answer for me, putting aside for a moment the strict application, you know, of the rule, what is the purpose of requiring personal service as opposed to certified mail service on a John Doe?
Well, basically, it's because it's required by the civil rules.
I understand that, but why? And what would be the purpose if the civil rules would require it?
The purpose, I think, is because you're basically giving the plaintiff some additional time to identify the John Doe defendant, more so than just the 2 years that he've already had. So if you're going to give the plaintiff that additional time, it's a reasonable requirement to say, okay, you have to do more to serve this defendant than you might have done had you figured out before you filed your lawsuit who that defendant was. So I think that's a reason to require the personal service. And it is required by the rules and by this court, and the appellate court just simply ignored that requirement. I will let Mr. Wright speak now.
Thank you, Ms. Broward. Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, and may it please the court, although I'm sure you hear this a lot, after almost 24 years as a trial lawyer, I am truly honored and grateful to have the opportunity to appear before you. I recognize that the issues presented in this case may not be the most dynamic when compared to some of the issues you are called on to address. However, it is the fundamental vitality of the civil rules that allows the system to function in a fair, orderly, and consistent manner. While enforcement of the rules may sometimes seem harsh in their application, the absence of the civil rules, or worse, the unequal application of the rules, would result in chaos. We believe that this court has already established the bright line principles that should apply in this case. When all else is stripped away, the sound principles set forth by this case in Amerine and more recently in Gliazzo should not be disregarded. The complete failure by the plaintiff appellee to follow the mandate of Civil Rule 15D and the pronouncement of this court in Amerine should not be rewarded. However, anyone troubled by the outcome when the dictates of 15D are strictly enforced and when the principles of Amerine are followed need only look to the fundamental fairness principles articulated by this court very recently in Gliazzo.
Counsel, could you simplify this a little, for me at least? Can you walk us through what specifically plaintiff needed to do that failed to do?
I think I can, Judge. As a trial lawyer, not an appellate lawyer, I think I can, but I'll do my best.
When, where, and how?
Here's what he needed to do. Civil Rule 15D contains the word must several times, and the three musts that he did not comply with is he must aver that he could not discover the name of the defendant. That was not done here. The amendment must contain the specific words name unknown. That was not done here. And although they all contain the word must, and I'm not here to say one is more important than the other, the third requirement is that they must be served personally. None of those things were done here. And
how do you do that with respect to the clients involved here, the defendants?
How do you
serve them personally?
With respect to my client, you get an order from the court, and you can serve them personally, just like you do anywhere else.
Okay.
Mr. Wright, looking at 15D, it seems to be somewhat inconsistent. If the name is not known, how do you identify where personal service is to occur?
I don't think you can at that point, but I think you have to follow the dictates of the rule, and then when you do discover the name, you have to follow the requirements of 15D in order to perfect service and to take advantage of the saving statute.
So at some point, the John Doe needs to be identified.
Absolutely.
Personally served.
Correct.
All right. Thank
you. And once the John Doe is identified, the summons still has to state name unknown, even though you now know the name before you personally serve him?
That is the requirements of the rule and of Amerine, as I understand.
Would be familiar with what the purpose of that would be?
I've thought a lot about that and a lot about the question that you asked, Ms. Brohard, as to what's the significance. If you're on notice with certified mail, why are you requiring this extra hoop? I'm not sure I have a great answer for that, but I thought of my own children when I asked them to do something. And I would get back the response, well, why are you asking me to do that? Sometimes I find myself saying, because I said so. I was never comfortable with that. But what I am comfortable with is you do need rules. And rules, by their very nature, are arbitrary. And in this situation, he did none of the things that were required to be done in order to properly perfect service. And that's why I referred to this court's recent decision in Gliazzo, because I think some of the language fits this situation perfectly. And in that case, the court said, the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure govern the conduct of all parties equally, and we cannot disregard the rules to assist a party who has failed to abide by them.
Counsel, I think that the crux of the Court of Appeals reasoning is found in its last paragraph of its opinion, in which Judge O'Toole pretty much says, well, she does say, the service of process is a practical thing, not an abstraction for the delectation of legal scholars, and the courts of Ohio should construe the civil rules regulating it in a practical light. What that translates to me is attempt to do it the right way, or some kind of loose substantial compliance argument. How does that attitude or that analysis bear on how we have treated adherence to civil rules in the past?
Justice O'Connor, I am troubled by that. I'm troubled by a couple of things. Number one, that decision never even mentions the case of Amerine. But again, as a trial lawyer, I just need to know what the rules are. I'm not saying 15D is the best rule in the world, but it's the only rule that we have right now. And until another rule is promulgated, I think the courts need to enforce the decisions of this court. And by allowing, you know, he tried, I think that's going to create a lot of confusion.
You've used your time, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Berkey.
Mr. Chief Justice, fellow members of the court, counsel, Bob Berkey for the plaintiff appellee. I likewise am honored to be here. I've avoided the court for 40-some years of practice, and but it is a pleasure to be here. We're visiting the issue here of the interplay of 230519 together with 3A, 15C, and 15D of the Ohio Revised Civil Rules, and exploring this certified question that comes up because of the conflict in the district courts over 15D or over 2305.19 is the as applicable to the case. One of the things that I found in the briefs of my appellants was that they did talk about the stream, and we both and all sides prepared and filed a number of cases or cited a number of cases, and I can tell the court I have not sorted through and said, you know, there's 20 cases on this point and 20 cases on this point and how to do it. But even hearing their argument today, I think everybody is in agreement. I mean, the parties are in agreement that 15D gets the benefit of 2305.19 if, in fact, there is compliance with 15D. And the question is, what are the levels of compliance that will meet due process and the code and the civil rules as it relates to the administration of the case law or the management of the cases that go through that are subject to the civil rules.
So, counsel, are you saying when it says personal service, that's not a mandate and that's not really meant that it has to have personal service?
The question has come up two occasions now about personal service and the policy behind it or the reason behind it.
Delve into that? What you know? Why they put those words together and that constitutes the rule? Is that the place for an examination of the wisdom of the rule?
If in fact, as we have found in any, this is a notice type of civil rules that we are dealing with. Number one. Number two, if in fact, as a practical matter, service is made. And if, in fact, there is an opportunity for the defendants to be heard without default, yes, it does comply. We believe in this instance, let me talk about the futility of personal service. For example, China Shipping was a foreign corporation. Now, how would we serve China shipping? By personal service? Well, it would be by certified mail addressed to the Secretary of State's office. Or would we run a courier down and say, or a process server down?
Well, I can't believe that the plaintiff here was the first plaintiff in, since the civil rule was enacted, to come up against these questions. There's solutions to all this.
Well, there are solutions, but I might add, for, as an observation, that the number of cases dealing with John Doe defendants and the kinds of problems that it creates, there's obviously some internal defect of the statute. There's any number of cases that have been decided, many of which we've cited in our respective briefs. So, yes, there. This is a problem area, and is it properly addressed, or should it be properly addressed by, you know, looking at that civil rule, or should we? But in this instance, we have to deal with the practicality of a case that's been brought properly. That is, the John Doe defendants were properly named. We're getting fairly hyper technical, in my opinion. They ask about 12D, for example, 12D, the averment of the unknown defendant. Well, we listed it as John Doe unknown. I mean, is John Doe unknown and unknown defendant consistent? I mean, or is that a fatal defect? I don't believe it should be called upon. Or name unknown, I guess. I'm sorry, the civil rule says name unknown. There's no question. We did not do personal service. But again, the question at hand, which came from the certified question to the question that we have now, is there something less than strict compliance that would allow this case to go on? And if the court finds that that's the case, then we have not only we have the affirmance of the case from the 11th District Court of Appeals, and this matter will be reset to the Trumbull County Court, where all the parties have entered an appearance. All the parties have filed an answer and or other appearance. I believe one filed an answer, one filed a motion to dismiss. But so we have all the parties in court in what I would call the totality of the circumstances. They've received notice of the summons. They've received. Well, let me back up just a minute. One of the things is the court has no idea, because it's not part of the record, how difficult it was to find out who these defendants were, these unknown defendants were. Certainly, if it takes up to a year, we should get the benefit of the of the statute.
Counsel, what was the nature of the why were you looking for them? How are they connected to the injuries?
The primary defendant, who was served, Atlas, right. Salvage, was served. They process steel.
That's where your client worked.
And these boxes come in by way of China Shipping and Container Corps, and apparently, from overseas, they have to fumigate them. And so there was gas still residue in the box or in this container when it was opened. China Shipping, I guess, is my recollection now, furnishes the box, and Container Corp was the one that was handling the box or container that came in from overseas.
But why was it so difficult to ascertain where these people were? Their identity, their, you know, location, et cetera.
That was information that was retained by Atlas, and it took discovery and pounding of table. Well, again, this is not part of the record, but that was the issue, was getting information from the other defendants.
But if I recall the facts here, this was filed on the last day of the statute. Is that correct? 2 years had passed?
That's correct. The initial complaint was filed on the last day of the statute. That's correct.
All right.
Mr. Berkey, Mr. Wright has raised the issue for us that
We have a rule that's quite clear on its face. Some of our rules are not, but this one seems to me to be pretty clear. You obviously didn't follow, at least no argument about the personal service requirement. Should we be concerned about certainty and for the bench and the bar and how the rules are to be applied? And is it not the preferable interpretation or application of us of our rules to apply them as they're written, instead of having exposure to any number of situations in which, or circumstances in which, substantial compliance is argued, or we got close but we didn't quite make it, and interests of justice and so forth, we get this sort of conundrum given to us now and then, and this seems to be a pretty good set of circumstances where we can speak to that issue, that the rule is a rule, and it's pretty clear how you comply with it, and if you don't, you suffer the consequences.
Well, I've certainly, I say to you, if it says personal service, we did not do personal service. Why the court should, we sent it out certified mail. Apparently, even though I would argue as to China Shipping, it was probably, because it was a non-resident corporation, was probably appropriate. As to your specific question, Mr. Chief Justice, I believe that the law, as Rule 1A or 1B says, that these rules are designed to be to help in the administration of the cases, and we should get a just result. In other words, litigants should not necessarily be tripped and out of court just because of a difficult statute or a difficult rule. And we have a difficult rule here based, as I already alluded to, based upon the number of cases that come through this court. So I believe that the court can look beyond this, as the 11th District Court of Appeals did, in saying, well, look, let's look at this from a practical point of view and say what did happen. And what did happen here was that the plaintiffs, the defendants, the John Doe defendants, once they were identified, were served, made every appearance, had their day in court, and it was all done within the time frames of the admitted requirements. That is, if we got service, we get the extended time through 2305-19. So we get the additional saving statute to proceed in this matter. And that's what we are asking the court to find in the affirmative on the certified question and to sustain the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Berkey. Ms. Brower, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the issue of that all the parties are already in the case anyway, so what's the point? Once we, the defendants, are out of the case, Atlas cannot file a cross-claim against us because we're no longer there. It could file a third-party case. However, Atlas, as the plaintiff's employer, could only be liable for an intentional tort. And under common law, if an employer is found liable for intentional tort, there's no right of indemnity or contribution. So we could not get back into that case once we're out of it. On the issue of whether or not they could find China Shipping, there is, and again, it's not in the court's record, but there was discovery from Atlas presenting a letter from Mr. Berkey to Atlas's attorney before the statute ran saying, I need to know who these people are. The Atlas attorney wrote back to Mr. Berkey and said, here they are, China Shipping. Gave him the name, address, and everything. And Mr. Berkey had that either at or shortly after the time he originally filed the lawsuit, and yet didn't amend.
And it is overseas?
No. China Shipping, they had a Cleveland office, which is where they served by certified mail. There's also an office in New Jersey. It's part of an international shipping company, but there is U.S. presence.
Counsel, would you agree that when we look at these cases involving the rules, there is some natural tension between what was sought to be accomplished by the rules and the rules themselves? That what was sought to be accomplished is to get us away from strict pleadings and fatalities of failing to, you know, the old demur practice and all of the things that horribles that, that happened if you didn't dot every I and cross every T. And so along with the rules was a statement that we are switching now many years ago to notice pleadings. And that's what we have. So there is some natural tension or some indication from the rules themselves that a more relaxed approach than was previously the case would be in order. Would you agree at least with that?
There is some natural tension there. Yes, sir, I do agree. But at some point, some rules have to be followed. For instance, the statute of limitations is a bright line. You miss the statute, you're out of here, no matter if you're one day late. Maybe it's arbitrary, but at some point you got to say enough is enough. And we believe that this is one of those rules where you have to say, sorry, you got to follow the rule. And if the rule isn't clear or is it a good rule, then there's a process by which the rule can be changed. So we would ask that the opinion of the appellate court be reversed, that the trial court decision be reinstated, and that the certified question be answered in the negative.
Thank you, Ms. Broward. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.